Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. In the past week, both the Biden administration and Governor Newsom declared monkeypox a public health emergency. The declarations essentially open up access to emergency funding to ramp up and streamline vaccine clinics, treatment, and outreach, especially to the most vulnerable communities. Governor Newsom says California will build upon the infrastructure from the pandemic, but the initial response to this new public health crisis has been criticized for repeating similar missteps to COVID-19. Even though a vaccine and antiviral treatment already exists for monkeypox, availability is limited across the country, creating once again a responsive catch-up with long lines for vaccines, test results that can take so long it pretty much renders them useless, and not enough antiviral treatment to go around for a virus that is rarely deadly but can be extremely painful and require hospitalization. State Senator Scott Wiener has been concerned and critical about the public health response pretty much from the beginning. The Democrat from the Bay Area is now the chair of a new select committee at the state capitol to improve the state's response to the monkeypox outbreak. Senator Wiener joins us now. Good morning.
Morning.
Just curious, in the past week, we have California and the Biden administration declaring a national emergency to monkeypox. And you, in your view, what prompted the national and state emergency declarations in the past week?
Well, it's good that they've been declared for a variety of reasons. We've been in an emergency situation for a while, and I do think that our state and local health authorities have been taking it quite seriously and treating it with a sense of urgency from the beginning. The federal government, honestly, has been incredibly slow and flat-footed, although that is finally beginning to change. This is spreading significantly. And although it is thankfully not as contagious as COVID is and not as deadly as either COVID or HIV, it is still a very serious illness. It can be extremely painful. It can be very harmful. And we know what to do to shut it down, and we just haven't gotten there yet.
It's been some 3 months since the outbreak first began in the United States, and you called the onset of the response a federal public health failure. You said that the federal response has been flat-footed. Can you unpack that for us? What was so flat-footed about the response from the federal government in the very beginning, going back to May?
Where do I begin? It actually begins long before this outbreak. And just to be clear, monkeypox has been circulating among humans, mostly animal-to-human contact, since 1970. For the last 5 years, it's been circulating at least in Nigeria with human-to-human contact. So as of at least 2017, the world knew that there was human-to-human transmission of monkeypox in Nigeria. There were physicians in Nigeria who were trying to get people's attention on this. So we also know that experts have been telling us for quite some time that monkeypox was eventually going to spread outside of Africa and was going to come here. And then on top of that, we know that we have a vaccine that works for monkeypox. It's the smallpox vaccine that the U.S. government funded. This is the JYNNEOS vaccine that's not a live virus, so it doesn't have the same side effects as the old smallpox vaccine. It's been around for a long time, and in 2019 was officially approved for monkeypox. And yet the U.S. government stockpiled over 20 million doses of it and let them expire years ago without replacing them. And then once this outbreak started and we had an inadequate supply, we allowed some of our vaccine to be shipped to Europe instead of to the U.S. And then we had a supply of freeze-dried vaccine that simply needed to be bottled, but the U.S. government delayed asking the manufacturer to do that. And so now we're several other countries are ahead of us in line. So time after time, the U.S. government, the federal government, has dropped the ball.
So I would imagine it's fair to call this response a catch-up?
Yeah, a desperate, desperate catch-up. And right now in San Francisco, it's sort of like the Hunger Games with people overwhelmed, gay guys having to wait in line for 6, 8, 9 hours in the hopes of getting a shot. It's really tragic to see this. And then the city keeps running out of vaccines. San Francisco has as many cases as L.A., but L.A. is 12 times bigger than San Francisco. So my city's being very badly hit. but it's starting to spread in other counties as well.
When it comes to the antiviral treatment, there's also backlogs and difficulties as well, right? When you're talking to physicians and doctors who want to prescribe this, isn't it a lengthy paperwork process?
Well, it is, but the tragic there, it's a antiviral called TPOX, T-P-O-X-X. It's a smallpox treatment, and the U.S. government has almost 2 million doses or 2 million full treatments stockpiled, so enough for almost 2 million people. It has not been approved by the FDA as a treatment for monkeypox, however. And so as a result, even though there's plenty of it to go around, we have 6,000 diagnosed cases or something like that in the U.S. And 2 million, ability to treat 2 million people. And what that means, because it hasn't been officially approved for monkeypox, is that physicians, in order to when someone comes in excruciating pain and they want to be treated, the physician has to fill out hours worth of paperwork. It used to be 20 pages of paperwork. Now it's down to 6 pages. But I just was speaking to an ER doctor last night who said it takes him about 2 hours to jump through the hoops for each patient. He doesn't have that amount of time. But when he is able to give it to a patient, it is incredible. Within a couple of days, their pain is dramatically reduced. The lesions have scabbed over. It really appears to work. Now that the federal government has declared a state of emergency, the FDA can issue an emergency use authorization for these treatments so that doctors don't have to jump through those hoops.
Why hasn't that happened then, if the FDA can do that?
I don't know. I mean, there is limited data on the efficacy of the TPOX treatment for monkeypox. However, every treating physician that I've spoken to tells me that it is very clear, anecdotally, that this helps these patients and appears to have few, if any, side effects. And so I hope that the FDA will do it. I think the FDA has indicated they're going to start doing some trials, which of course they should do those trials. But we have an emergency right now, and we have people who are literally telling us that when they have rectal lesions, that defecating feels like someone is sticking a hot iron up your rear end, or that sitting down feels like you're sitting on broken glass. Or people who can't eat and have intravenous nutrition because it's in their mouth. People who are at risk of going blind because it's creeping. The lesions are creeping towards their eyes. This is an emergency for these people, and the FDA needs to move fast.
Yeah, I was reading an article. It's on our CAP Radio website from Jackie Fortier, who's with LAIS down in public media down in Los Angeles, and she was sharing the story of someone from the Bay Area. They had lesions up to their face, and the physician was concerned that this person would go blind. And the testing, though, that individual tested negative twice for monkeypox. Yeah. So can you unpack the inadequate testing that is currently available?
Yeah. The problem with the testing is that right now, the only way to test for monkeypox in terms of approved testing, hopefully this will change, the only approved test is when someone has a lesion and you swab the lesion. So first of all, that's a problem that you have to have a lesion. Not everyone gets a lesion. Most people do, but not everyone. And the lesions may not be your first symptoms. You might have flu-like symptoms first, or you might have had a severe exposure, someone you had sex with who you know had monkeypox, and they can't test the person because they don't have the lesions. And so, but then when you do test the lesions, it's apparently really easy to get it wrong, that you're not swabbing vigorously enough, probably because it's very painful to swab the lesions. And so you can understand why a healthcare worker doesn't want to cause unnecessary pain. But if you're not getting an adequate sample from the lesion, it might come back as a false negative. The good thing is there is now one or maybe more tests that are available. They're not yet approved by the FDA, that you can do like an oral swab. And I'm told that there might be tests also for rectal swabs, because we know that the virus has been found in saliva, in feces, also in semen. And so that would be fantastic. It'll be an easier test to do. You could have more asymptomatic or non-lesion kind of testing, and hopefully it'll be more accurate.
Although the majority of cases right now are men who have sex with men, gay and bisexual men, as well as the transgender community, it's not unique to this community. It can be much broader. Do you think the response would have been different if it wasn't initially connected to the LGBTQ community?
Well, this has been actually a debate. On the one hand, yes, there's nothing uniquely, you know, gay about monkeypox. It can be, you know, straight people can transmit it to each other, and so. But it did, how it entered, you know, Europe and North America was through gay men's sexual networks, because however the virus changed, as noted in Nigeria around 2017, it was being spread through more human to human through more sustained physical contact, which is, you know, obviously sex is the ultimate form of sustained physical contact. So it was spreading in Nigeria among people having sex. Now that seems to be how it's spreading here. It's not an STI in the sense that when we think of an STI, it's something that's like a chlamydia or gonorrhea that really is only or overwhelmingly going to be spread by sexual contact. There's nothing inherently sexual about this, but that is how it's spreading, and it went into gay men's sexual networks. And so we have to acknowledge that it's impacting gay and bi men, disproportionately white and Latino gay and bi men. And we have to, you know, in a non-stigmatizing way, focus on these communities and educate and focus resources. But, you know, we are starting to see a backlash where people are now once again, sex shaming gay men and attacking gay men and blaming us.
Do you think the response would have been more heightened? I mean, I was just looking at on Twitter, and you said if the broader society were being impacted, this absolutely would not be happening.
Absolutely. We saw with COVID, I mean, keep in mind, COVID was a virus that we had never seen before. Brand new virus. We knew almost nothing about it. The things we thought we knew about coronaviruses often didn't really seem to apply to COVID-19. I certainly didn't have treatments. It took a year to get a vaccine. And we saw the sense of urgency here. It's a known virus. We didn't know, don't know everything about it, but known virus with a vaccine, with treatment that we had stockpiled, and with at least a test, not the best test, but a test. And everything was so slow. I mean, the fact that we had almost 1 million doses of this vaccine that the U.S. government owned sitting at the manufacturer in Denmark, and it was sitting there stuck because the FDA had not inspected the facility where it had been produced. And we saw a delay of doses as a result. It was things like that. And I can tell you, if this were impacting the broader community, I'm pretty confident that TPOXX treatment would already have an emergency use authorization. And I bet you we would have new tests on the market.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and if you're just joining us, we're talking with State Senator Scott Wiener about the state legislature's new select committee in monkeypox response. You are chairing this new committee. I believe the first hearing is going to be tomorrow. What do you hope to accomplish?
Yeah, so first of all, I'm very grateful that our leader in the Senate, Senator Toni Atkins of San Diego, I went to her and said, hey, we need to do something, and we talked about it, and she authorized me to form a select committee. And so this will be one of the first times, that maybe the first time, I don't know, that we're having a public hearing. We will have a few different panels. We'll hear from our state officials from the Department of Public Health about what the response has been, what needs to happen. We'll hear from a treating physician, from UCSF, who's going to just talk about his experience and what he's seeing with patients and some of the challenges. We will hear from two different patients who have had and recovered from monkeypox in different parts of the state. We'll hear from our county health officials, and the counties play a critical frontline role here in testing and vaccination, et cetera. And then we'll hear from health advocates from different organizations that are on the ground. And I think we'll talk about some of the issues we've talked about today with testing, vaccination, et cetera, but also some other issues, paid sick leave. And we'll hear from a labor organizer around that, that if you get monkeypox, you may have to isolate for 3 or even 4 weeks, depending how quickly it clears up. And there are people who can't afford to do that. We need the state to provide financial support to the counties. The counties are so under-resourced for public health, which we really learned during COVID, and they are struggling. And yet they're now going to have to stand up vaccination sites and testing and do outreach. And so we've submitted a budget request for the end of our session this month to allocate about $38.5 million to the counties to help them with the monkeypox response.
You know, I think a big part of this conversation, especially when talking about the federal government and also just bureaucracy, can be slow. What are some meaningful goals that you are setting for yourself and your colleagues maybe in the next month or in the coming months or even by the end of the year?
Well, for this month, our legislative session ends August 31st at midnight. My main goal is for us to, as part of our budget process this month, to allocate this these funds for the counties and get that money out. We need to ramp up vaccination efforts. Obviously, I represent San Francisco, which has been the most hard hit, up with New York in the whole country. And so we want to make sure that we're getting vaccines into the parts of the state that really, really need them the most. We're advocating to get more vaccines allocated to California. Right now, California, Illinois, New York State, Washington, D.C., and Florida are the hardest hit. We want to make sure that we're really focusing that vaccine supply on the hardest hit areas and then continuing to push. We're advocating to the federal government to allow counties to use COVID health funds for monkeypox. Right now, I just learned that there is a nonprofit in the Mission in San Francisco, and our Latino community has been hard hit. They have nurses that are funded with federal COVID money that they are not allowed to use for monkeypox vaccination or testing or treatment. They can't use those nurses for monkeypox. So we want more flexibility in addition to getting the treatment an emergency use authorization so that it can be more abundantly provided.
How quickly do you think you could get that flexibility?
We sent a letter a few weeks ago to Secretary Javier Becerra, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Secretary. We haven't gotten a response yet. We're going to be following up. I've spoken with Speaker Pelosi's office about it. She's been terrific in helping us get federal action. But it's a little frustrating that the federal government isn't as responsive as we need it to be.
Given that this is the second public health crisis in less than 3 years, we talk about public health being historically underfunded, not to mention now just completely overworked. What does this tell us about how public health is equipped or not equipped to respond to the next contagious outbreak?
It's concerning. I mean, after what we saw with COVID, it really pulled the curtain back on the weakness of the American public health system, both at the state and local levels and the federal levels. And, and COVID, of course, was hopefully once in a century disaster, global pandemic. Monkeypox, it's not unique. We know we have plenty of viruses that are contained in different parts of the world that could spread. And we've seen whether Zika or SARS or MERS or different kinds of, flu strains that sometimes will break out. And we've been, through some good work, but also a little bit lucky that some of these other viruses or Ebola have not caught on, have sort of petered out. And sometimes it's because they're so deadly that they peter out. But this is the first time in a while that a virus that we've known about has broken out and is now spreading. And this could happen again. It doesn't have to be a COVID-level global pandemic. You can have other viruses like this. And we did not do what we needed to do, and especially a virus that we knew existed. We knew a fair amount about it. We had have a vaccine. We have a treatment. And wow, we just have allowed this to happen.
State Senator Scott Wiener, thank you for the time.
Thank you.
The Democrat from the Bay Area is now the chair of a new select committee at the state capitol to improve California's response to the monkeypox outbreak. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Here at CAP Radio, we often ask our listeners, readers, and viewers about the issues that matter most to them. When we ask, they tell us a variety of things, from wildfires to COVID to economic and racial justice. But for the past few years, the number one issue consistently and almost universally has been homelessness and housing affordability. Joining us now are CAP Radio's Nick Miller and Chris Nichols. Nick leads the newsroom, and Chris is our Sacramento reporter, who also focuses on the unhoused community and housing issue. Nick, good morning. Nice to see you in studio.
It's so good to be here.
All right. So you don't often join us on Insight, but I know you're here today to discuss a new project at CAP Radio that we've really been working on for, well, a while now, I think nearly a year. So this project focuses on communities in North Sacramento and areas in City Hall known as District 2, right?
That's right. And this is a unique project. And honestly, in my journalism career, something I haven't really been a part of before. And it all started with sort of this driving question of, like, which communities in Sacramento are we not serving? Who are we, you know, quite honestly, who's being ignored? And not just by CAP Radio, but by media outlets all over the region, right? And so we looked closely at some of the data for our membership, some of our audience data. And we started focusing on District 2 in North Sacramento. And I'm talking about the communities of Del Paso Heights, Hagenwood, Strawberry Manor, Robla. I used to work in North Sacramento on Del Paso Boulevard. I used to spend a lot of time in these communities. So I have an affinity for the residents in these neighborhoods, the restaurants, the places people like hang out and eat and drink. And so I was real excited that we were going to say, hey, we're going to, with intent, spend some time in these neighborhoods listenings. We did, starting almost a year ago, we started doing a survey of residents in these communities. And we also started holding some virtual listening sessions. And this was led by our team member, Jessica Maria Ross. And Vicki, we learned a lot. Again, even like the places folks love to eat and hang out, it was kind of cool.
Yeah, you and I were talking about restaurants in North Sacramento, and I was talking about one on Del Paso Boulevard, Colo's Soul Food.
That's right.
It was a new restaurant that opened up just before the pandemic, and I remember meeting the owner, Tamara McCree, and obviously, like most small businesses, was just slammed financially. They have the best food, and they have grown in the 2 years since. I highly recommend their smothered fried pork chop. It is fantastic.
That actually sounds, yeah, I'm vegan, but that sounds good for breakfast right now, too. And that's interesting you mentioned Colo's, because I was on an email chain with some of the community advisory residents we've been talking to for the past year. And that was one of the restaurants that they mentioned as the places they go to, they love to support. There's also this sentiment among the residents that, like, you know, Midtown, downtown gets a lot of attention for their restaurants. Even in South Sacramento, Little Saigon gets a lot of attention. But they're like, hey, here in North Sacramento, we have all these places. We have Colo's. They mentioned Hot Off the Griddle. They mentioned Lucky Express on Willow Street. There's a new J-Spot Grill. Everybody seems to go to this place called Shift Coffee. And I guess they have snacks and food. And it's like the hot little coffee shop that serves District 2. And then, of course, Tori's Place, which is famous near Grant High School for their fried chicken. And they have this fantastic flat iron cornbread that's just like buttery and like,
I love cornbread. Yeah. All right, you're getting me hungry. Now we got a little sidetracked to food and places that residents love to eat. But Nick, I mean, we're talking about people who have been neglected or ignored in news coverage. So can you peel back the journalistic curtain a little bit? What went into building relationships and ultimately trust with residents?
Well, it started with the survey, and then we just started meeting every month with a group or a cohort of residents. You know, we invited them to join us on Zoom. We did just icebreaker type exercises. I joined these meetings. Some of our reporters like Pauline Bartolone, Janelle Salunga, they came to the meetings, and they came consistently month after month to just make face and listen and sort of cultivate a relationship with these residents and not just hear their concerns. And, you know, but obviously residents had a lot to vent about. You know, I think the story that Chris Nichols published on our website today is rooted in one of the most critical pieces of feedback that we got from the community, is that we feel like, or the residents of North Sacramento feel like, they are a dumping ground for homelessness challenges and solutions in Sacramento. And I've actually witnessed that over the years. I mean, it's no secret that one of the first emergency homeless shelters opened on Railroad Road in North Sacramento, just north of the American River. We know that, you know, some of the biggest, most contentious battles for affordable housing solutions, and Chris reported on this, have been because they were proposed in District 2, you know, near Old North Sacramento on Arden and Del Paso. But, you know, the residents say, hey, where are the affordable housing solutions, the homelessness shelters in Midtown, downtown, in Land Park, in East Sacramento, in the Pocket, right? So that's sort of like a chorus of feedback we've been hearing, you know, through these meetings. And it's exciting this week to actually, you know, deliver some reporting that's rooted in those conversations, in those things that we heard, and sort of connect the dot and that through line back to the listening that we've done over the past year.
Yeah, amplifying those voices. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about a CAP Radio community series this week that really is the culmination of nearly a year of conversations with North Sacramento. All right, let's bring in Chris Nichols into the conversation now. He's been CAP Radio's lead journalist reporting on unhoused community and homelessness solutions. Chris, in your time as a reporter, what have you observed and seen as it relates to North Sacramento and homelessness?
Hey, Vicki, good morning. You know, I have heard those same concerns about North Sac being a dumping ground for the city's homelessness problems. And really, that's homelessness is a problem that residents feel has only gotten worse in recent years in North Sac. I spoke this spring with Deborah Cummings, a community leader from Del Paso Heights, and she believes that homeless people got pushed out of downtown Sacramento to the city's northern neighborhoods. She said this took place around the time of the development of the Golden One Center, and she said it continues today. But to solve the problem of homelessness, North Sac leaders told me they want to take a hard look at existing services and shelters in the area to see what's working and what's not working. And they don't want to rush into adding more shelters unless and until there's some really smart and community-oriented planning that takes place first.
Chris, your story just published this morning, which looks closely at the most recent episode of North Sacramento residents pushing back against affordable housing or homelessness solutions. Tell us about it.
Well, this is a story about homeowners in an upscale neighborhood in North Sacramento called Woodlake. And it's a small, single-family neighborhood with quiet streets, nice, charming, older homes. And it's right next to Woodlake Park. It details their opposition to a five-story affordable housing complex, one that's planned right next to the park and the former state armory. Nearly everyone I spoke with in the neighborhood told me that they support creating more affordable housing in general. They realize Sacramento has this severe lack of that kind of housing, but they also felt that this was a project that was too large, too dense, and would overwhelm their neighborhood. It would clog their streets with traffic. It would create huge parking hassles. I spoke with Woodlake homeowner McCalla Griffin.
It's not that this neighborhood or people in this neighborhood are against affordable housing. I want to make that very clear. And it's a little frustrating and insulting that, you know, it's been seen that this neighborhood, that's what we're against. What we're against is having any apartment complex, whether it is affordable housing, you know, luxury apartments in a very small area.
And this is a development that would include 124 units for residents, making anywhere from about 25 to 60% of the area median income. About one quarter of those units would be reserved for formerly unhoused individuals and families. And the city council, in a narrow vote, gave the project its blessing in May. But neighbors in Woodlake, they're still very concerned about it.
Nick, what are your thoughts about this?
There's such a so Woodlake is a more a wealthier enclave within District 2, and I'm really curious too as we continue to listen and do some follow-up reporting with our community advisory committee that we've established in North Sacramento, and then just talking to other residents, how other residents who are in less affluent neighborhoods feel about projects like this, like in Del Paso Heights, Hagenwood, Strawberry Manor, along Noralto. Because the feedback I heard during these meetings is they're concerned about, you know, young people's exposures to unhoused communities and like how that makes them feel about their neighborhood. There's also some concern about, you know, I don't know if this bears out in the evidence, but there's concern about the danger of young people being going to school or going to after school programs near unhoused communities. And we don't really have data that demonstrates that that is a threat or something that's of immediate concern. But that's a real feeling in the communities. I talked to a lot of business members, like a woman who owns a supermarket near the border of Northgate and Noralto along the Greenbelt. And a lot of people will come into the supermarket who are unhoused and they just need like basic services, essential services and help. So I'm really curious as Chris continues his reporting and as we learn more and this project, which is planned and approved and scheduled, we'll see if it actually comes to fruition, you know, how these other community members feel about it who may not have like the wealth and class privilege of the folks in Woodlake. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Chris, and this is going alongside Sacramento County's unhoused population has just surged.
It has. And, you know, there's no doubt that today people are probably more frustrated than ever by the amount of homeless encampments. And also they're, you know, upset about this housing shortage. We have the shortage of affordable housing. They're cited as some of California's top concerns. But as I found in my reporting, that doesn't necessarily mean that they want these solutions right in their backyard. A lot of the times they say they just want them somewhere else, a little further down the road. And looking to the future, Sacramento County, it has a shortfall of nearly 60,000 affordable homes for its lowest income renters. That's according to a recent report by the California Housing Partnership. And the county is also short several thousand homeless shelter spaces. Those are typically full on any given night. And so while we're probably going to see neighborhood groups continue to speak up about their concerns on new development, especially when these large, dense new projects are proposed, you hear from housing advocates and advocates for people experiencing homelessness that the region really needs this big, huge wave of new construction of affordable housing just to meet the basic existing needs.
Yeah, and Chris, we're talking right now about North Sacramento, but these are issues that impact so many residents beyond even just the city of Sacramento. But in your reporting, how does this story affect all Sacramento residents in the city?
So I think that the issue of neighborhoods opposing affordable housing, I think that affects Sacramento and its residents in a couple of different ways. One, that resistance, including the lawsuits that sometimes pop up, those can delay a project, it can scale down a project, or in some cases even defeat it. And that means it takes longer to create Sacramento's needed affordable housing. It also means that people, maybe younger people getting into the housing market or the rental market, they have to pay higher prices for that existing limited stock of housing. I spoke with UC Berkeley affordable housing expert Carol Galante. She weighed in on what this neighborhood opposition can mean for a project.
Well, the big picture is one, then the costs go up significantly. So even if that development ultimately happens, you know, it can take 5 years, you know, 8 years to resolve the issues, resolve the lawsuits. And that means, you know, construction costs are going up 10 or plus percent a year in the past number of years. And so then you need more funding to make it happen. And then that increases the housing affordability crisis.
Yeah, I mean, this issue isn't in a vacuum. It has ripple effects that ultimately affects everyone. Finally, Nick, this is just one story in a series that's going to be unveiled this week. Tell us about the other stories you're working on.
Yeah, that's right. Residents surfaced a variety of other issues, Vicky, including everything from feeling that they historically are not represented at City Hall. And we were seeing that bear out again here with the city's investigation into current council member Sean Lalowie, who is being accused of not living in the district, being accused of living in Granite Bay, but also like wanting more investment in young people to create more opportunities for young people and also to curb youth violence. So we're going to have a story Monday through Thursday this week that focuses on these issues. And again, the residents in the community surfaced these issues with us, and now our reporters are out doing the work.
I'm just curious. My last question, you and Chris have been local journalists and residents in Sacramento for quite a while. You said yourself when you led with this that you haven't really embarked on something like this before in journalism. I'm curious what surprised you most with this project, diving into North Sacramento and listening to residents' concerns and solutions that they would like to see in their backyard.
It's really fun to me. I love the intent of it, right? I love that, you know, we're in a very deliberate way going to community members and asking them, hey, tell us what issues matter to you and tell us which ones you want us to prioritize. And then we're going to go out and do the work for you. I mean, I always say as journalists, we're in the service industry, too. And this is sort of like an essential form of that public service.
How about you, Chris?
I think it's just the complexity of these issues. I mean, we've reported for years now on the needs when it comes to affordable housing and homelessness, but that doesn't mean neighborhoods, individuals want a cookie cutter solution. They, you know, the solution has to be planned out. It has to be tailored to a neighborhood. Otherwise, you know, they will oppose it and they'll make it very difficult for that project to succeed. And so I've really learned a lot listening to the North Sac residents about getting the right project for the right neighborhood.
Chris and Nick, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Becky.
And that is Cap Radio Managing Editor of News, Nick Miller, and Cap Radio reporter, Chris Nichols. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Stan Lee is regarded as the godfather of comic books because of his pivotal role in writing many of the Marvel Universe's iconic superheroes. In 1986, in the Fantastic Four comic issue 296, Lee confirmed the home of Mr. Fantastic, Invisible Woman, Human Torch, and The Thing as Stockton, California. However, Stockton isn't just home to superheroes, but also Stockton Con. Stockton Con is in its 10th year and is the Central Valley's gathering place for all things pop culture and entertainment. Like many superhero origin stories, the event began small, but over the past decade evolved and grew into costume contests, gaming tournaments, panels, exhibitions, vendors, and much more. Joining us now is Mike Millerick, president of Stockton Con Events. Good morning.
Hey, Vicky. Thanks for having me.
How did StocktonCon evolve over the past decade?
Wow. You know, when we started back in 2011 with essentially just an email to the United Way president at the time, Andy Prokop, that really kind of started us down a path. We had our first event in 2012 and did it at the University of Pacific and had a really nice turnout over what we expected. And it just kind of grew from there. And you know, the support that we've had from the community and sponsors and that sort of thing has really just helped us, you know, just have what has evolved into a fun event on a yearly basis, obviously with an exception a couple of years ago.
Yeah. You're going to have the event kicking off this weekend, this year's summer event. If someone's going for the first time, kind of help us visualize what everyone's going to be taking in.
Wow, that's a great question. I think that you know, when you get there, there's so many different ways you can go. There's vendors, there's celebrities, there's artists, there's, you know, video game tournaments, there's card gaming tournaments. So there's a lot of different things that you can do, and it's kind of just about what your interests are and what you want to kind of do first. I mean, you've got 2 days to do it. So we're open 11 to 5, both Saturday and Sunday at Stockton Arena. So once you walk in those front doors, it's kind of like whatever you're interested in, there's probably something there for you.
Yeah, something for all ages. I mean, for anything from pop culture to anime to sports and obviously comic books. You're even going to have some celebrity guests at the event, right?
Yes, Ron Perlman, who is has a little bit of a Stockton history to him. He played Clay Morrow on the show Sons of Anarchy. So Ron Perlman is kind of like in that role, played someone who lived in the area around Stockton, charming the fictitious city there, was kind of in between Stockton and Lodi. So it's really going to be kind of fun to have him here for the first time. And Ryan Hurst, also from that show, will be there as well. And, you know, we've got a ton of guests. It's probably one of our best guest lists we've ever had, with some of the artists that we have and some of the celebrities. John Heder from Napoleon Dynamite, Karen Parsons from Fresh Prince of Bel Air. A lot of just kind of great folks that are going to be there this year.
Yeah, you know, I would. The Marvel Universe and DC Comic Universe and on the big screen has just obviously ballooned in recent years. Mm-hmm. I would imagine that has paid dividends to events like StocktonCon.
Absolutely. I mean, that was really a kind of around the time that San Diego Comic-Con kind of blew up. I started going to that event in about 2009. And, you know, you just saw the things really elevate from that point. I mean, it was already very well attended, but you know, in 2011, 12, you could not get a ticket for it. And now it's nearly impossible. But, you know, it's really funny that you mentioned that in the opening about the Fantastic Four 296. And I grew up with the Fantastic Four as my favorite comic book. And to have that kind of reference Stockton, and it was just really amazing to kind of see, you know, as a kid. And then, you know, obviously that tie to Stockton really, you know, kind of just really puts it all together for us.
Yeah. I mean, people obviously love the movies and the comic books. What do events like this add to the love for pop culture and anime and comic books?
Well, I think that when you're at a comic convention of this nature, pop culture event, you know, you really can just kind of see a little bit of everything. I mean, you know, when you can meet some of your favorite celebrities, you can meet Art Adams, who actually drew the Fantastic Four, who's, you know, from Northern California. And, you know, to be able to come and meet him at the event is awesome. And also, you know, you can find things that you might not be able to find in a store, like some vintage comics or vintage, you know, toys or whatever you're looking for. There's some great artists that are going to be there in our artist alley as well.
Did you have StocktonCon last year?
We did. We had it in September 11th and 12th last year. And, you know, of course, that was our first event back after not being able to have an event in 2020.
Yeah. What were the learning lessons from that year to now, this summer StocktonCon event, in terms of kind of riding out uncertainty with the pandemic?
Sure. I mean, there's definitely, you know, there's definitely been a little bit of a switch in the last couple, in the last year or so. But I think every event that we do and every event that I even attend, either as a fan or as a consultant or anything like that, I'm always learning. I mean, and just kind of seeing how everybody is taking everything in and what we feel we want to do with our events.
Hmm. The event is $20 for tickets, right? But that's to both days of the event, and children 12 and under are free, right?
Correct. Yeah. So you can buy in at different store locations throughout Northern California. If you go to our website, there's a list. But yeah, it's $20 for a 2-day ticket. And then at the door, it's $30 for a 2-day ticket. And 1-day tickets you can buy online. You can buy for either Saturday or Sunday. And those are $16. But we made the 2-day ticket a really good deal. So that's probably the way to go.
What kind of attendance are you expecting this weekend?
You know, we're hoping that people come back a little bit. And, you know, we obviously last year, you know, it was kind of our first step back, and this is our next step. And we're really looking for a great turnout. We've had thousands of people come through the Stockton Arena in the past, and, you know, working with them and making it a great environment for folks to come and have a fun event is really everything that we could do. We love working with Stockton Arena, and that's a huge thing for us as part of the Stockton area. And then we're just getting ready for our next event in October at Lodi Comic Con.
You know, when I think about the event in Sacramento at the convention center, and when you're in downtown and midtown, you kind of just see this kind of fan of costumes all throughout the city center, which is just wonderful. I would imagine this is also a pretty nice boost to look for local businesses in the area.
Yes, for sure. And you mentioned, you know, Sac Anime down at the convention center. They do a great job, and we, you know, partner with them as well. So they have such a great great turnout of cosplayers, and we do as well. And you know, a lot of fans that come out and support local businesses. Obviously, the University Plaza Hotel and surrounding, you know, restaurants and other businesses too.
Mm-hmm. Finally, if someone is showing up, it can be kind of overstimulating in a good way. You know, there's so much going on. Do you have like a recommendation for an itinerary, what to tackle first and kind of make your way through the 2 days and make sure you cover everything?
Well, I think it really depends on what you're really wanting to do. If you're looking for the, you know, kind of the best comics and then, you know, Funko Pops or action figures or whatever you might like, you know, you might want to hit the main floor first. But if you want to come and meet like Ron Perlman or Art Adams or, you know, John Heater, who was Napoleon Dynamite, any of our celebrities or artist guests, you know, Bill Morrison drew some of the Simpsons and Futurama stuff. You know, there are folks you might want to get to early because they are very popular as well. So, you know, tackling the things that you want to get first are always kind of the most important things to do.
What are you looking forward to the most?
Oh, you know, I think I get asked that question a lot, Vicki, and I think my favorite thing at Stockton Con is always when I can see a family and I can see like a young kid, boy or girl, and they can see somebody dressed up as Spider-Man, and just kind of the look on their face when they look up and they kind of say, "Hey, Dad or Mom, look, it's Spider-Man," and we, you know, take a picture with him and stuff, and the smile on those faces, it's like it's immeasurable.
When you go back to 2009 and you went to Comic-Con, and now you're seeing that evolve here in Stockton with Stockton Con, did you ever think it would get to this scale and grow as it's grown in the past decade?
I mean, I have to be real honest with you. I didn't. You know, when we first started the first event in 2012, you know, we just wanted 500 to 700 people maybe to show up at our event. And we had over 4,000 at the first one. So that kind of blew me away right away. And then, you know, just to get to where we're at in the level of celebrities that we get and the amount of them and just everything that we do is, yeah, I mean, I would never have guessed that back in 2009 or even 2011.
Mike Millerick is president of Stockton Con Events. Thanks for joining us, Mike.
Well, thank you so much for having us.
And you're going to have a great time. Stockton Con takes place August 13th to 14th. And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you want to join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Corral Martinez, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Antonio Munez. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.